Background noise is kettle of water boiling. In the office of John Kao, the founder and CEO of Edgemakers, it's an eclectic place. It's got a grand piano. There's a popcorn machine. He's got an assortment of different technologies and recording equipment. There's pictures scattered around of John with Bill Clinton and boxes labeled Harvard. John's here today looking to make himself a cup of tea. And then we're going to get started and talk about a few things ranging from innovation to Asia.
You ready?
Okay.
Okay.
This is Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. It's the Innovate episode, and my guest, as you've already heard, is John Kao. I've known John for years. Dubbed Mr. Creativity by The Economist, John sometimes calls himself an innovation activist. He's been on faculty at the Harvard Business School and MIT, authored several books, and even advised a number of countries on the subject of how to speed up innovation. He also plays the piano. There's a lot of people play the piano, of course, but John is serious about it. So serious, there's a Steinway & Sons piano in the center of his office, if you can call it an office. It's more like a space, filled with loungers, sound equipment, piles of books and posters. I started off by asking, why the piano? Why now?
Well, the simple reason for having a piano, in this case, not just any mere piano, but a Steinway Model D, meaning a 9-foot, 10-inch concert grand piano. I mean, the simple-minded answer is that if I want to practice, I need to have a piano. And so why have a situation where I'm unable to practice during the day or during the evenings when I'm in the office? But I think the larger reason is that for me, having spent much of my professional years looking for the wellsprings of creativity and innovation and how they work in society and government and business, music has become a very powerful methodology for me to actually explain to a wide range of audiences how the innovation process works.
What came first, the music or the innovation?
Well, in a way, they happened at the same time. I mean, I started doing music when I was 5 years old, and I discovered jazz when I was 12. And, you know, jazz always had a certain mysterious quality for me because it's music that's created in the moment and that has to sound good and that is based on building a set of capabilities that require a lot of practice. So in that sense, it's an almost perfect analog for what innovation is about. You know, it's not just generating the new idea, but actually having an idea that has value and that is generated through a process that requires practice and repetition.
Do you think the original jazz players had this notion of innovation in the back of their head, or is it something that they just did? And therefore, are you trying to kind of carry these ideas across into the business or the engineering communities?
Well, I think that jazz musicians, especially, 100 years ago, probably weren't that intellectual about what they were doing. They had this overwhelming desire to create musical beauty, and so they established a high watermark of what beauty was for them, and then somebody else came along and innovated the idiom and made the music sound even better or different. And that tradition of kind of competition and cooperation is very much a hallmark of jazz, because in the 50s especially, there were these customs called cutting sessions, where musicians would get together after the real gig and they would just play together. But they were cutting sessions, as in, I'm going to be so much better than you that I'm going to cut you off the stage. And so this idea somehow of pushing the envelope and the social aspect of learning was very much embedded in jazz. And, you know, the more you look at jazz traditions, the more you see that the way people learn to be jazz players, the way they collaborate in bands, the way bands are led, the creative process when a musician is at their instrument, you know, all of these things have analogs into the business world and the world of leaders. And the thing that fascinated me, and I wrote a book about this 20 years ago called Jamming, which, is still in print, which is one symptom of how people have looked at this as being relevant for them. But, the whole idea was, what can leaders learn from jazz musicians? What can we all learn from jazz musicians? Because in a sense, we're in an era of history which you could call the age of innovation, because the only thing that really countries and companies have is the ability to innovate more rapidly and more effectively than their competitors, or to become eminent through innovation. But I would go further and argue that a big part of the age of innovation is actually the age of improvisation, which is the ability to fluidly invent new sources of value as a capability, and not as a set of, you know, old-fashioned management exhortations. And so I do this thought experiment sometimes when I give speeches. You know, I pick somebody in the audience and I say, there's a special event after my talk, which is you're going to give a jazz piano concert. And we're going to do all the things that a good manager does. We're going to clap. We're going to encourage you. We're going to make you believe you can succeed. We're going to show you in the corporate value statement where creativity and innovation are core values. We'll have a great piano. We'll take all of the social risk out of your performance and so forth and so on. And I go on and on. And, you know, the point is that unless you've been practicing in secret for 10 years, you won't be able to do it. So all of that stuff that passes for good management is, it's, I wouldn't call it irrelevant, but it's quite secondary to making the process of innovation come alive. So jazz musicians know about innovation, even though historically they may not have been so articulate about it. And these days, of course, there are tons of young, smart jazz musicians who are very articulate about it. You know, one of the things I'm doing is capturing a whole bunch of interviews with jazz musicians of all ages to kind of capture this knowledge.
So there's also the aspect of discipline. You talk about discipline in your book as well, that every great innovator or every great jazz musician or businessman has to bring into his life or into his practice discipline. How does that apply?
Well, you know, music is about discipline. You know, there's a discipline of, you know, there's the discipline of harmony. You know, this is a major chord, and that's not a particularly harmonious sounding chord. So understanding the architecture of music, having the motor skills, then understanding what sounds good and what doesn't in a jazz idiom. So, you know, what's exciting and not boring. You know, all of these things require discipline because there are rules, and the rules are wired into the structure of the human ear and how we hear it. The rules are structured in terms of the physics of music. And, you know, as Miles Davis said, you have to learn the rules in order to break them.
Right.
Right. Which is, by the way, what entrepreneurs do. Yeah. You know, entrepreneurs don't just do whatever they feel like doing. They, you know, there's the discipline of, you know, profitability and human relations and strategy and all that kind of stuff. But they have to know the rules and then they break them.
So take us through this. So when you take this out and you speak with corporate leaders and you walk them through jazz and you play the piano, give me a little riff on how you would do this. How would you kind of then examine and explain the music and then apply it to business or the need to innovate?
Well, I mean, first of all, I make a contrast between playing a tune as if you're reading off of the notes of the sheet music and then improvising. So, you know, if you have a tune like All the Things You Are, and this is the sheet music version. And, you know, the sheet music enables that and only that. And you could play it with different phrasing. But the net effect is it quickly becomes quite boring. So the challenge of a jazz musician is to kind of, you know, and then the real challenge is to play a new melody. So instead of to play a new melody. And, you know, the point is, I didn't think about those new notes. At all. I mean, they were coming from some familiarity with the tune and the jazz idiom and muscle memory and so forth and so on. So once people understand that there's a capability at work here. This isn't just, you know, sitting down at the piano and playing whatever notes you feel like, because, I mean, this is what playing whatever you feel like, and this is what it sounds like, you know, it's...
chaos.
Yeah, it's, well, it's random, right. You know, it doesn't conform to a language, right? So part of the jazz musician's job is to create a story that is perceived as being aesthetic and beautiful and justifies buying a ticket or a CD or, you know, going to a concert.
So now apply it in the world of business, in the world of entrepreneurship. These are the aspects. This is the framework. These are frameworks. And then when you speak to others and try to instill in them ideas of innovation, development, design, because I know you've been across a lot of these areas, how then do you transcribe what you're talking about with the piano into business language?
Well, look, I mean, I don't want to reduce my kind of work in innovation just to the jazz example. I mean, the jazz example is useful for several reasons. One is it demonstrates that innovation is a capability and not a set of wishes. Secondly, if I were to set up a situation where, for example, there was another jazz musician who I deliberately didn't meet until the moment of going out on stage, and then we played a tune together, I could demonstrate the high level of collaboration that results, which is a function of empathy, listening, reading nonverbal cues, but most importantly, having a collaborative ability to create in the moment, and that is inherent. I mean, that's part of why we think of jazz as being exciting and interesting, is because people go out on the high wire and they perform these magical feats of creating new notes that sound good. The other thing that becomes very important is what the Zen Buddhists call beginner's mind. So I said earlier that I wasn't thinking about anything when I was improvising, and I really mean that. I think that to improvise fluidly is to be able to keep the voice of judgment outside or suspend judgment in the interests of exploration, which most people and most organizations have a very hard time doing, because there's a legacy overhang of the way things are supposed to be done. I mean, I know for me that the music always sounds better the less I'm thinking about it, or the less I'm kind of tuned into the context and I'm paying attention to who's in the audience or what the stakes are for that particular event. And then another point, and there are many points, but, you know, these are some of the key ones, is that, you know, jazz is about a negotiation between contradictions. So, you know, in the case of what I just demonstrated, you have the song. And then you've got every note. And then how do you kind of craft something which is a resolving of the creative tension between the notes as they're written versus the notes that you want to discover? What is the creative tension between you as a solo voice versus you playing with other people? What is the point of resolution between you as somebody who's familiar with the traditions versus somebody who's going into the future? And so every note that you play becomes a resolution of certain creative tensions in the moment. And, you know, experience shows that that is exactly what goes on in the mind of an entrepreneur or a great leader. There's never an algorithm or a very fixed set of reference points. You know, there's always a kind of a negotiation among creative tensions that leads to a decision in the moment that is good enough for that particular moment, but then there's the next moment and the next moment.
And how do you reconcile that? Because you look at, you know, corporations today, as you alluded to before, and they're becoming overly structured in so many different ways. You know, there are examples of where they might have skunk work operations within their group, but they're typically isolated. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that kind of, at least in the work that I've done with executives, you don't get that flow through, that willingness to release, you know, let go of the structure and allow the creativity to come through in that Zen moment and thinking about it. None of that exists. At least I don't see that in your traditional work organizations, maybe in Silicon Valley firms. But how do you can kind of impose or bring these ideas and then see them executed within corporations? Are there any examples of where you've kind of lectured or worked with organizations and they've then deployed in keeping with this idea of bringing, you know, entrepreneurship and innovation, you know, as just it displayed through jazz into their organization?
Well, I mean, it's a very basic aha, which is most of the stuff we think is relevant to managing innovation really is not relevant. And so we have to start understanding what the capabilities are that we choose to focus on and to practice and to become really good at. And, you know, that question eludes a surprising number of senior people, you know, and so they think of managing innovation as culture building and mood setting. And that's in my mind, always secondary to, you know, what are the hard capabilities that are relevant to innovation? You know, is it about strategic foresight or brainstorming or design tools, or is it about creating an innovation context, talent management, acting like a venture capitalist? There are many elements of the skill set, and not all organizations can be good at all of them. So just to embark on the road of understanding that there is a task of defining what you want an innovation agenda to be, what you want from innovation, what you're trying to accomplish with it, and then how you're building that agenda is quite valuable, I think, for a lot of people. Then, you know, this idea of fluidity, you know, in some respects you want, I mean, again, there's always this tension between the exploring side of an enterprise and the operational side. And you don't want them to contaminate each other. So that's another creative tension, you know. So you mentioned skunkworks. I mean, skunkworks can be, it's just a word, but it can be a highly effective or highly ineffective process. But the idea being, in my mind, that every organization is a blend. It's a hybrid of the today organization and the tomorrow organization. It's almost back to, you know, the old hypertext software tool that Apple put out, where, you know, you see something, a phenomenon in a layered way. So you have the need for operational excellence and inefficient and wild discovery, right? Well, how do you reconcile those in one organization? Typically, you know, at least if you read the Innovator's Dilemma playbook, you know, you've got to set up mechanisms that support both, and you've got to negotiate both. I did some advisory work for American Express way back when Lou Gerstner was running the travel part of American Express. And he said something once to me that I've never forgotten, which is, you know, he said, in my organization, there's more money coming in and out on a daily basis than in many countries. So, and this is a direct quote, I don't want to hear a lot of laughing out of the accounting department. But on the other hand, if we're not disrupting the existing models of credit cards and travel and so on and discovering new approaches, then we're going to go out of business. So, and this is the key point. He said, my job is to make sure that each side of that equation feels like it is the savior of the other. And so in that simple statement, you know, is encapsulated a lot of wisdom about what jazz musicians have always known. Jazz musicians talk about finding the sweet spot. And it's not something that's given or that you can read off of a piece of sheet music. It's something you discover with other people where you're in a groove or you found a place where it's good to stay there for a while with other people because the music sounds really good. And that sweet spot's going to shift.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. I'm talking to innovation guru John Cale about the surprising connections he makes between innovation and jazz. I've just asked him if there are companies who have actually put his wild ideas into practice. What corporations have shown a willingness to let go of structure in the name of creativity? One quick note. During our conversation, John makes reference to something called skunkworks. As some of our audience is going to already know, the idea of skunkworks came from Lockheed Martin, where it was the official alias of the company's advanced development programs. Today, skunkworks just means a small group of people in a company who works on a project in an unconventional way. The group develops things quickly with minimal management constraints, just as they did at Lockheed Martin with the idea of eventually incorporating whatever product or service they're developing into usual business processes. On the one hand, corporations know they need some form of skunkworks, but on the other hand, they resist the idea, fearing perhaps a breakdown in conventional hierarchy and processes. I asked John why that was the case.
I think a lot of companies are engaged with these questions. You know, everyone defines their own metric, so it's hard to say that there's, you know, one objective metric that you can apply to all companies. But I think that it's difficult. And the reason that it's difficult is because the rewards for leaders and managers tend to skew towards the operational side, the legacy side, the tyranny of quarterly reports. There's the tyranny of doing things the way they've always been done. And there are often penalties for taking risks, you know, so you take a risk and, you know, venture capitalists are in business where if one out of 10 ventures investments work out pretty well, you're a rock star. And that mentality is very different from the typical kind of custodian manager in an organization. I will say, however, that I think all organizations need to have an innovation agenda. And furthermore, that innovation agenda needs to be a relatively comprehensive one. You know, what I find also is that, you know, people are looking for the new kind of formula of innovation, like they were looking for the formula of quality in the 80s. And they just want a mechanistic tool that they can apply to themselves instead of understanding that, you know, creativity is an intensely human endeavor. It's not efficient. And, you know, the job of the manager is really to create the conditions around which creativity will emerge. And that without creativity, there's really not excellent innovation. I mean, you can have innovation that burnishes or polishes up an existing model. But these days, there's so much disruption going on in everything, you know, career paths and technologies and, you know, customer franchises and business models that, you know, organizations that are not able to articulate a point of view about how they manage creativity, how that flows into innovation and how that translates into business value, I think are in really bad shape.
Yeah, and I'm seeing it everywhere. And this is one of the concerns that a lot of major corporations, you know, in the boardrooms, they're sitting around asking, what could we do differently? And it's all typically around, well, let's throw some money at something. And, well, let's define that. And will that then pass, you know, the approval of our shareholders? Mm-hmm. And then it circles back and they're stuck once again. But disruption is the motivator for many people right now. They see them creeping. I met with one of the big Asia Pacific CEOs for one of the big hospitality groups. And I asked them, what's your greatest concern? And they said, Airbnb. I mean, you know, who would have thought? I mean, this is one of the top five-star kind of hotel chains. And yet they see inevitably they're going to have to do something about it. And they don't know what to do.
Well, and the reason they don't know what to do is because they don't have a process internally for orchestrating the kind of thinking and effort that would be required to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, organizations are tend to be focused on efficiency and on, you know, predictability and scientific method and planning, and creativity is in an organization is really none of those things. I mean, it's nonlinear, it's inefficient, it's messy, it often can't be measured. It involves dealing with temperamental, talented, creative people, and most managers, it's out of their comfort zone, right? And which is, by the way, why a lot of organizations will innovate via M&A. You know, they'll buy a company, but then often they don't know what to do with the company, so they'll destroy it in the course of acquiring it and trying to integrate it into their day-to-day. But, you know, that's a very well-defined path in areas like the pharmaceutical business or others where, you know, you don't have the horsepower to do the innovation internally. So you buy the capacity to do it and, you know, have it be part of your kind of constellation.
Let's pull back for a minute. I mean, where in the world did all of this fascination with innovation come from? I mean, you taught at Harvard for 14 years. Right. You've been at MIT Media Lab. You've written several books on this. Innovation Nation was about innovation within government. Your current Edgemakers is about innovation in the classroom. What is this obsession with innovation, and why are you across this? And you know, can you bring me back to the origins of this, or can you actually identify when this first kind of struck you as a theme that would kind of craft your life?
Well, I'm pretty clear about the origin story these days. You know, I'd better be since, you know, given my sort of advanced age at this point. But I think part of it came about because my parents came to the U.S. in 1949 from China. And then I got born shortly thereafter and grew up in suburban Long Island, New York. And I was an only child. So basically, every day I had to go back and forth between two radically different kind of cultural environments. So my parents, who were academics, were very open-minded, but they were still pretty Confucian in their way. And then, you know, the sort of America of the 50s and 60s was the opposite because, you know, the codes were different. You know, in China, you don't talk about your accomplishments. In America, you talk about them all the time. And I had to learn how to function in both environments. So a lot of the theories of creativity say that creativity comes about when you force two frames of reference that are irreducible to each other to coexist in the same space. And that was the story of my life, really, number one. Number two, there are three elements. Number two was I discovered music really early. I started playing the piano when I was five. And this whole idea that you could make a connection between something neuromuscular, like hitting pieces of wood on something called a piano and beauty. was quite a revelation. And then the third, interestingly enough, came about because of my early interest in science fiction. So I, when I was 10 or 11, I found this book, which was actually the original story for Star Trek before Gene Roddenberry. And it was about this big interstellar expedition, lots of different disciplines, lots of science.
Who wrote that?
It's a book called The Voyage of the Space Beagle by A.E. Van Vogt.
The Space Beagle?
Yeah, as in The Voyage of the Beagle, like the Darwin Beagle. Yeah. So there was one guy who came on board at the last minute from the Department of Nexialism. And unlike the specialists, you know, he had a whole bunch of knowledge that was integrated into a framework that included knowledge of military science and psychology and influence techniques, communication theory, you know, anthropology, business models, and engineering, right? Just to sum up a few. And I thought when I read that book that that would be a great career for me. And then I realized that that career path didn't exist because it was fictitious. But if you look at the steps along the way for me, you know, technology and behavioral science and, you know, all of these different disciplines that I've kind of put together in my nonlinear career, it's almost startling how much it mirrors that original DNA. So what has interested me always is the how of creativity. It doesn't really matter whether it's in the Hollywood, which I, you know, I produced a couple of feature films, or Silicon Valley, you know, I started companies there, or Broadway, I produced, you know, some Broadway theater, or, you know, how it works in scientific laboratories with biotech companies and things like that. It's all part of the same phenomenon of how do certain people at a certain moment in time in a certain organizational setting come up with great ideas that they develop effectively that lead to disproportionate amounts of value. And there's been an inadequate amount of attention that's been paid to the how. People are really interested in getting, you know, getting it so that, you know, it's give me more of that. There's a focus on the what, you know, so great stories of entrepreneurs or whatever, but not so much on the how. I had a very kind of eclectic background, which included some really deep experiences in, you know, clinical psychology and psychiatry and behavioral science. And I always was fascinated by the human dramas that led to the expression of incredible ideas. And that was not in vogue and still is not so much in vogue in management science, which tends to look at people as, you know, interchangeable widgets in the corporate factory. Right. But that's precisely the problem, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to get creativity if that's your approach to human resources.
I think millennials are recognizing this, right? There's a departure from the normal career track and a desire to maybe do 17, 20 things in a lifetime and keep learning, lifetime learners. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways, maybe that's just we've tapped out on, you know, how much of a cog can you be? And now it's time to go back and be something else. But you've seemed to live this. And you know, you're getting, your listeners are getting the feel. You've done so many things. You even have a medical degree, right? You're constantly exploring and experimenting in the whole bit. It's almost a message to everybody else. Like if you want to kind of live a full and wonderful and exciting life, you're going to have to surrender something. And maybe it's diving deep on every single subject, or maybe it's just doing it as you do. You know, you're so disciplined and committed to so many different things you've done. But I think, you know, I'm worried about when I see the state of corporations and I see the limitations placed on people and kind of you're put in a box and asked to do that job. And if you don't do it exactly right, out you go. And I do believe that we're starved for this type of creativity, and it's limiting. And I think of this in the context of the United States. You've written an Innovation Nation. You're worried about, you know, the diminishing of government innovation or government R&D and its impact on us from a competitive perspective vis-a-vis other markets. Could you tell us a little bit about that and also discuss, you know, your perceptions on Asia and China specifically and their rise in the world right now?
Yeah, so America, in a way, had, I won't call it a free ride, but it had a lot of natural advantages for being an innovation nation. For one thing, post-World War II, we were really the only game in town because the rest of the world was damaged and we were not. We had great universities. We had a really dynamic economy. And so talent flocked to the U.S. We had government funding for all kinds of mostly technology-related initiatives, but also education and things of this kind. And so for a long time, the roots of innovation were adequately watered. And the reason I wrote Innovation Nation was because I felt that America as a country could no longer really assume that the past was prologue. Because if you look at high school dropout rates, you look at the funding of science, the divorce of the arts from public education because of funding issues, you know, many, and the fact that innovation and entrepreneurship are becoming global, so it's no longer a Silicon Valley monopoly. It's, you know, you can start companies anywhere. I wanted to make sure that in America, at the senior policy levels, people had an understanding of what the root ingredients of the innovation at societal scale were and how to make sure that they wouldn't inadvertently cut them off. Because, you know, an innovation society is hard to generate. You know, you have countries like Singapore that have been very intentional about trying to build an innovation society and engineer it. And in a way, they've been very successful. But, you know, Singapore is obviously a different kind of country because it's much smaller. Scale is an issue. But, you know, the thing that America has, which is hopefully going to be a uniquely differentiating element for the duration, which is why people want to come here and continue to want to come here, is that we have a culture that forgives noble failure and tolerates wacky ideas. Mm. And there is no other country in the world that really has that. I mean, in Finland, which is a very innovation-driven country, and I know this well because I advise the Finnish government on their national innovation strategy. If you go bankrupt, that is a real stain on your record. Whereas in Silicon Valley, you know, people say if you haven't gone bankrupt at least a couple of times, you're not trying hard enough. Mm. It's a very different kind of attitude. The thing that's going on right now is, you know, innovation in some respects is becoming the new black for countries. And there's probably upwards of 40 or 50 countries that have national innovation strategies and agendas and chief innovation officers and so on. It's an interesting time because the approach to grounding or rooting an innovation agenda varies tremendously from country to country. So it's a time of great experimentation. And it's a time where different cultures are coming to the fore in terms of their relative comparative advantage from an innovation perspective, to use an old economics term. So Asia is very interesting because, you know, you could argue that Confucianism has been a break on innovation because it has created templates for people to fill in, whether it's in business or, you know, government, you know, the whole civil service exams concept, or even the way people study art, which is basically to copy other people's art until you get to be, you know, white-haired and then, you know, innovate something to embellish the pattern and then pass it on to your descendants, as opposed to the kind of disruptive innovation, which is about, you know, killing off the current understandings and doing something dramatically new, and which is also about subverting the authority structure of age. Because today, you know, young people often know a lot more than older people about technology and entrepreneurship and business models. You know, academic knowledge may not be as valuable as it once was for being a great entrepreneur. So just being a professor is no guarantee that you're worthy of veneration. So there are a number of obstacles. You know, I wrote about this back in the 80s. I wrote a Harvard Business Review article on the World Wide Web of Chinese Business, which looked at the kind of canonical Chinese entrepreneurial mindset, which was, you know, focus on risk mitigation, hire your relatives because they're the ones you trust, and have your bags packed at all times. And, you know, there's still, you see this now. I mean, there's capital outflows from China. You know, people are still making bad HR decisions in terms of hiring less competent relatives as opposed to highly competent professional managers. And there's a lot of Me Too stuff, right? So, you know, I mean, supposedly there were over 1 million high-tech startups in China last year.
A million.
That's what I've been told. But I'm sure a lot of them were Me Toos or, you know, maybe, you know, not as we understand them in Silicon Valley. However, the thing that's interesting about China is that it has made a significant commitment to innovation. So I was there in December and, you know, it seemed like every university and government agency was setting up an innovation policy think tank or institute or, you know, program of one kind or another. So it was a very good time for, in a sense, for me to go there. And, you know, the Chinese approach to innovation is going to be different from the American approach. It's going to have its own cultural characteristics. But also the other thing that is going to be, in a sense, a real benefit is the law of large numbers. So if you, let's say that one out of, you know, one out of a thousand ventures, one out of a thousand in China is really, you know, a worthy venture. I mean, that's not a very polite percentage, but let's say it's one out of a thousand. That means there are a thousand rock star ventures that were started there last year. And there's lots of money there. And there's lots of social mobility and fluidity and an increasing acceptance of the idea that, you know, you don't have to have a branded education or do things in a standard way. So I think, you know, China is very promising, you know, in terms of the innovation and entrepreneurship equation.
To what degree have companies like Alibaba and Huawei, you know, generated this idea within China and among young Chinese that they don't have to go the Confucian path, they don't have to work in state-run organizations or be part of the bureaucracy? I mean, it clearly must have inspired them, but then there's this discord, there's this tension, like you say, between the cultural aspects and the expectations of people, and then this freewheeling, innovation at all cost, and look at the results. It's not like the United States in that regard, right? There's kind of a grinding that's going on is what I see culturally.
Well, I think the scale of the innovation ecosystem isn't as big in China as it is in the U.S. because you can start a company anywhere and, you know, you can find money anywhere and, you know, you can find counter-dependent people who are willing to join a venture anywhere. I mean, the thing that's interesting about the Alibabas and the Huaweis is that they kind of create their own ecosystem. So, yeah, I mean, Alibaba has a university. It trains, you know, up people to be entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial leaders. And, you know, it is a prime example of that whole generational phenomenon. You know, in America, we had, you know, Fairchild, which begat Intel, which begat a zillion companies in the digital space. You know, Apple has spawned, you know, hundreds of companies. So the Alibaba alumni are going to be a very powerful force in China, and the alumni from, you know, other, you know, Tencent and other big companies as well. So, you know, once you have that bench strength and you have this sense of, okay, there's a first generation that made money and they can be angel investors and they made mistakes so they can give sound advice, and then they spawn a whole bunch of new people, and they in turn, those in turn spawn yet another layer of people. You start to get a real community of entrepreneurs and innovators, yeah, which is key.
So just like the HP, this is China's moment. This is the kind of first phase. And to what degree is that a real risk to the United States and U.S. companies? And then also reflecting on our next U.S. administration that's stepping in and some of their, right, you know, I think conventional notions about the way the world works. I mean, what kind of imposition will that have on the changes in China and the way that we engage, you know, commercial to commercial, forget government to government?
Well, I'm not sure that commercial to commercial is really going to change much unless there's a some kind of unexpected disruptive event, which, you know, would be a military problem or some really aggressive, regressive regulatory regime. I think it'll, for the foreseeable future, I sense that it's likely to be business as usual. But I think that there's a big atmosphere of uncertainty right now that you know, nobody likes uncertainty. We like to have, you know, a clear operating environment that, you know, where we know where the goalposts are. But I think, you know, the silver lining here is that, you know, uncertainty causes us to question all of our assumptions. And, you know, right now we're in a period of questioning a lot of assumptions about geopolitics and alliances and national business models. And, you know, anytime a lot of people think about that stuff, hopefully, you know, there's a constructive side to that as well. Mm. You know, in terms of the non-zero-sum nature of innovation, I think, you know, a creative Germany or China or Brazil is, you know, net-net good for America. It's not a disadvantage.
All right. Yeah. You know, let's come up to date. You are the founder and CEO of an organization called Edgemakers. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the business, what the objective is, and your thoughts about introducing innovation into the classroom, K-12?
Sure. So Edgemakers is a learning system to help primarily young people, but not just young people, learn the deep capacities and skills of innovation. So, you know, in this era of loose talk about how important innovation is, I like to say if you want innovation, you have to have people who know how to do it. And if you want people who know how to do it, you have to help them learn how to do it. And up until now, there's really been no learning regime for innovation. So, you know, what I've done is to harvest my sort of eclectic teaching and life experience into EdgeMakers, which is focused on high school, college, young professional, and increasingly into the continuing education area, which, you know, I did a lot of work in already as the guy who founded the Harvard Business School Executive Program on Innovation and the MBA Program on Innovation. So EdgeMakers is primarily focused on the classroom experience, but there's a whole digital initiative going on to make the assets available online and also available to self-directed learners. And I describe EdgeMakers as integrated, practice-based, and purpose-driven. What I mean by that is we don't just focus on the lightning bolt of, you know, a creative insight. We say edge-making is the whole process. You have to generate ideas. You have to know how to take ideas and realize value from them, which is the entrepreneurial process. But you also have to know how to develop ideas, which comes about through disciplines as diverse as design, narrative and story telling and story development, collaborative strengths, digital fluency. And we've put this all together into a very coherent package that can be consumed by teenagers or by senior executives.
And is it based on the idea that these skill sets simply are non-existent in your traditional public school classroom or any classroom today? And are you suggesting that unless and until, because of this dearth, there needs to be some kind of toolkit that's deployed in order to support young people and even post high school kids in developing these skill sets?
Yeah, I think that my vision for EdgeMakers is that we would be empowering an entire generation of young people to learn these skills so they can make a difference ahead of schedule, and that it should be something that is embedded into every education regime. I mean, you think about what a citizen needs to be able to do now in the 21st century. They need to be able to grasp complex issues and make change and be able to tell truth from falsehood on the internet, which is a big deal these days, and, you know, interact with people very different from them. All of these skills are really edge-making skills, but they're kind of inherent, I believe, in what it takes to be successful both professionally and personally in the world as it is today.
So is the education system failing us? Is this an indictment, or are you simply saying, you know, it's just this is a private sector initiative to try to deploy, you know, supplementary tools in order to help the system?
Well, we don't want to be adversaries to public education. And in fact, our focus is primarily on educational institutions in this phase of developing the company. So, yeah, I mean, we look at ourselves as being, you know, kind of vitamin pills for, you know, the ingredients that don't exist. But, you know, we also say very clearly that our belief is these skills are not being taught except by accident. You know, if you're managing the soccer team or you have some other kind of lived experience that teaches you some of these skills, well, great, but it's not baked into the curriculum. And these are not academic disciplines where you sit in a room and hear a lecture and take a test and then you know how to do it. It would be as if you said, back to the music, you know, you're going to hear a lecture on a piano playing, and then you're going to see a PowerPoint presentation of different pianos, and then you're going to know how to play the piano. You have to sit down at the piano and play the piano.
Experiential, then.
Right. Practice-based. Yeah. And then purpose-driven is because, you know, this Gen Z that we're very enamored by is very much aware that the world is a mess and they want to do something about it. And that's the ahead of schedule piece. So we weave issues of sustainability and conflict resolution into our curriculum because we want to build a constructive sense of activism among young people. But I want to make the point that while our hearts are with the enablement of young people, EdgeMakers is really a learning system and set of tools that's relevant for executives, government officials, young professionals early in their career, and then people in education as well. But that's the full roadmap.
This really is a rolling up of your life's work in many ways, isn't it, right?
Yeah, this is life's work. I mean, it's I get to, as you say, roll up a lot of different pieces and reflect them in the curriculum. And also, you know, I'm at the stage in my career where I want to kind of focus on what it is that I can codify that's kind of the leave behind.
Yeah. John, excellent. Thank you so much. It's been great spending time with you.
Great pleasure. Right, thanks.
That was my conversation with innovator John Kao. This is Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. For more information about who we are, to download our other episodes, for information about how to reach John Kao and find out more about his work, head to www.insideasiapodcast.com. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.